The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of five youths.
You don't want to go fooling around other folks' property.
In particular, Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother, Franklin.
Sally, they took the keys. We don't have any keys.
I hear something. Stop.
For them, an idyllic summer afternoon drive became a nightmare.
Grandpa's the best killer there ever was.
Hit this bitch!
The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Dude, it's the best movie of all time. It's really relentless. It moves really, really, really fast. And just the way the movie looks, I mean, you really get that feel like you're right there watching this. It's almost like documentary style filmmaking a little bit. It's just an amazing movie. I first saw it at a drive-in. And way back in the day, my dad took me to the drive-in. They were showing three movies. They were showing Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Halloween 2. And all great movies. And I was just blown away by this movie. I was like, holy, this is just crazy. Because I've never seen anything like it before. And it's just an amazing movie.
Welcome back to Scream Addicts. My name is Jason Jenkins. Call me Jinx. And the gentleman you just heard speaking is Patrick Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds is a filmmaker who wrote and directed the 2011 horror thriller Rites of Spring and directed The Devil's Dolls, a horror film which will be in theaters and available on demand by the time this episode airs. As you should have been able to tell by now, Mr. Reynolds has chosen Tobe Hooper's 1974 classic, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for discussion today. So, Mr. Reynolds, thanks so much for being on the show and for choosing such a great film to talk about. I got to ask, of any horror movie you might have chosen, any at all, why zero in on Texas Chainsaw?
It's probably the first movie I saw that had the biggest impact on me. And every time I go, like, I think about everybody, I always ask me, what's your favorite horror movie? And I was like, that's the first one that just pops into my mind, my Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because it's like the perfect movie. That and Halloween are pretty much toe-to-toe as the perfect horror movie that anybody could watch and generally go, yeah, this is top-notch horror filmmaking.
Absolutely. I agree entirely. And, you know, it's funny. I just revisited the movie for this discussion. It had been about a year since I'd seen it last. And, you know, a few episodes back, I talked with Tom McLaughlin about The Exorcist, and I noted that that's one of the few horror movies that doesn't really lose its impact on repeat viewings. And watching Texas Chainsaw over the years, I got to say, it's pretty much true of that movie, too. I mean, the violence hits as hard every time you watch it, even if you know what's coming, even if you expect it. And it's can you think of many other horror movies like that that work that way for you? Or would you agree with me about Texas Chainsaw that it has that sort of impact?
Totally. It definitely has that sort of impact. And every time I watch it, I'm always amazed about how fast it moves and how the pacing of it is just look really relentless and quick. And there's really not a lot of blood in the movie. If you watch, there's really none at all. And the chasing between Sally and Leatherface probably has to be one of the longest chase scenes in any horror history.
Yeah, I agree. It is crazy that the movie is nearly bloodless. I mean, you know, when the film was cleaned up in that 4K restoration and put on Blu-ray, you can tell that I was kind of surprised that there is a bit more blood than I'd previously considered. Like, you know, when I first saw the movie, it was on a really, really sort of bad VHS copy, and you couldn't quite see the blood spatter when Franklin is getting chainsawed, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the blood running down the body when somebody gets hit in the head with a hammer, say. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, I think it has a reputation for, I think horror fans know better, but I think with the mainstream, you know, when you say the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, people assume that it's this really incredibly gory film, and it's really not. I mean, there's probably a cup of blood in the entire film spread out, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, you go back to that Franklin scene, is that now you can see a little bit of the blood that they were spraying when Franklin gets killed there in the woods. But also, Texas Chainsaw Massacre has the best title of any horror movie probably ever.
Oh, totally.
The movie just wouldn't have worked. It was called Head Cheese, but it was, when I was young, you'd always want to go see that movie. You'd be like, oh man, I'm going to go see that movie because it's called Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah. And it is crazy to think that, I mean, some of the things that Hooper was considering at the time, like calling it Head Cheese or calling it Leatherface, or, you know, I think I read somewhere that initially the plan was to aim for a PG rating.
Yeah, it was PG. And, well, that I have like a couple books on it, and I think Scum of the Earth was another one of the titles that they were going to. And yeah, they were going for, because he was telling the cast, I think, this is from the books, that, oh yeah, he's going for a PG rating in this. And they're like all looking at each other like, there's no way in hell this is going to be PG.
I can't even imagine like the same film being shot today, not having any issues with the MPAA. I got to imagine they would battle for an R again, not because of the blood or anything, but just because of the overall tone, which seems to be something that, you know, some horror films are hit on sometimes, but.
Yeah, it's pretty relentless, especially the scene with Sally at the end when they're giving her to Grandpa.
Oh my God, you're right, it's unrelenting from the moment that they strap her down to the chair. It's just it's so incredibly unnerving, especially that great sort of 1-2 punch, those freak out montages when the camera is close on Sally's face and there are those jump cuts and we get so incredibly close to her eyes, and it feels like, as an audience member, we're kind of going mad right alongside her.
Yeah, those eyeball shots are pretty fantastic. And I really haven't seen those used in any of... Well, D'Argento does it a lot. But just the way that whole dinner scene plays out is just fantastic. And they try to do the same. It just shows what a good director that Tobe Hooper is. They try to do the same type of thing in Texas Chainsaw at the beginning. And with the dinner scene, it just you just can't emulate how great that is.
Yeah, it is curious. How do you feel about the sequels and the remakes and the follow ups and whatnot? I think they all sort of have their merits in a way. I mean, not all of them are very good, but did you see the first film like straight away? Because my first experience with Texas Chainsaw was actually seeing the third film, Leatherface, first, and I had to sort of backtrack as a kid. But yeah, what was your experience? Did you see the first one first and then just move down the line?
Yeah, I saw it at 270 Drive-In in St. Louis with my dad, and that's when I fell in love with it. And then, of course, we had it on VHS, and I'd rent it every weekend with my buddies. But then I saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, and I liked that just as much. I thought it was great. I thought it was a nice – it wasn't playing like the first movie. It totally went off in a different angle. And I thought the set pieces at the end and that town or underground, that, you know, that carnival was really, really great. And Leatherface is great too. The part three is really good. And there are aspects of the remakes that I like a lot, and there are aspects of the remakes that I don't really care for too much.
Yeah, same here. I was kind of surprised at the 2003 remake for being as good as it was. At that time, the notion of remaking a horror classic was still relatively new. I think by that point we had had
the first, wasn't it? The first kind of...
Well, there was Psycho in 98, and I think that was the one that sort of knocked the wall down for being, you know, for telling people that there was nothing was sacred, you know?
Right, exactly. And there were great aspects of the remake that I really loved. I thought the house was fantastic.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I thought Leatherface was really, really cool, too. I liked that they just kept him, you know, they didn't explain what he was, and he was just... You know, and Jessica Biel is always nice to look at, pretty much.
Yeah, even the you know, when the prequel came out, I think it was in 2006. I remember it catching so much hell from fans and critics alike, and I remember thinking like that it was one of the better. I mean, it is an official chainsaw movie, but it felt like one of the better chainsaw imitators. It's just so sort of bleak and unrelenting, and there are stretches in that movie that reminded me tonally and sort of the level of tension of that original movie, but it doesn't get a whole lot of love.
I actually liked it better than the remake.
Same here.
I actually really liked the motorcycle gang. I thought that was very 60s, very 70s-ish. And I mean, a lot of the way the Jeep turns over, a lot of it is just great. I thought it was, yeah. And the look of it felt a lot more authentic than the remake. Not as glossy, not as hip looking.
Which is crazy considering that the remake was shot by Daniel Pearl, who's the same guy who filmed the original movie. But, you know, the original film almost feels like a documentary at times. You know, it was shot on 16mm. It's very sort of gritty. You can see the grain even in the 4K restoration. Yeah. Whereas, you know, in the 2003 movie, it's super slick and gorgeous. And you can't believe that the same guy shot it. But
it is really gorgeous. Like, I revisited a couple about a month ago, and just the part where Jessica Biel's hiding in the meat factory, and she's hiding in the locker, and he's walking through the looking for her. It's just a great scene. It's a really, really good scene.
I will say, at the time, I was working in a movie theater, and I previewed the film, and you know, by the time you get to that scene where she's hiding in the locker and she lops his arm off, I mean, by this point, we've, you know, whereas the original film is almost bloodless, I mean, there are like rivers of gore, it feels like, in that remake. I was kind of stunned that they managed to get it into theaters with an R rating, given that, you know, just a few years before, well, better part of a decade, but still, like, you know, apparently Wes Craven had an issue getting Scream into theaters with an R rating. And then you have Texas Chainsaw, that remake, where it's like, my God, I don't recall seeing a movie this brutal in a mainstream release in a long time.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal. My main problem with that movie is that the sheriff is sort of crazy right off the bat. I thought that would have been nice if they just would have kept him a little bit like he was actually a sheriff and he wasn't just a crazy man.
Yeah, and it would have been a nice callback to the original movie where we meet the cook, you know, the Jim Seto character for the first time. And, you know, he seems like a kindly older gentleman. And when Sally rushes into his arms after being chased by Leatherface, we get the feeling that, you know, there's a bit of salvation there. And it's such a cruel twist when we find out that, you know, he's in on it, too.
Exactly. And Jim said he's just a great actor in that scene, too, when he's like poking her in the car. My favorite scene, actually, is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. One of my favorite scenes is when he puts her into the he puts her into the van, and then he realizes he left the lights on and he has to go back out and turn the lights off. It's just like, why would you? Because now today you just cut that. Yeah. Everybody, oh no, we're going to cut that because we need to move the pace. But right there, I was like, that's just great. You know, it just camera stays there. He gets out, turns off the lights, comes right back in. It's really cool.
He's such an interesting character too, that guy, because, you know, at first we buy him as being somebody who's going to save Sally. And then, of course, he winds up being one of the family and he puts her in the truck. But, you know, the entire time that he is telling her that everything's going to be all right, they're almost there, it's OK, he's poking her and prodding her with, you know, and he's like a sadist. He's torturing her. And it's the same thing when they get in the house. You know, he talks about being morally above killing. You know, he just he doesn't have it in him to kill. And yet he's also one of the first guys who suggests that
they should, you know, give it to Grandpa.
Yeah, exactly. And put a hammer in Grandpa's hand so he can slaughter. Like, he's a crazy character, but he's not crazy in the leering, giggling sort of way that the Hitchhiker is, or the sort of vicious, brutal, murderous way that, you know, Leatherface is. He's his own kind of crazy. And I think he's kind of one of the more fascinating characters for it.
He's very, and I always thought for the longest time that he was the dad. And it was only like years later when I get it, that I find out that he was just another brother. So I always thought that was pretty interesting as well.
Which is crazy to think. I mean, my God, what was that family like, them growing up together?
No, yeah, that's what's so great about it is, you know, that whole conversation when Sally's, you know, when he's talking about the Grandpa was the best, you know, the hook and pull gang could have got, you know, if the guy could have got the bees off faster, he would have killed more. And I'm just like, that's just great dialogue. You just don't write anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just it drags you further down into that hell that Sally is into, like all of those little details and all of the little things that are said in the dialogue. It just, it's so masterful the way it's done. And I don't think the movie, even for people who like the movie, I don't think it's given credit for how well made it is and how well written it is.
And you know, the sound like design is just amazing, too. I mean, they just, it's, you know, Potts, and they're beating on Potts, and they have that old camera footage that they speed up and stuff. It's just, yeah, the sound design really helps that movie a lot.
Yeah, even that scene, you know, I was noticing it this time. There's almost a Raimi-esque moment where, you know, a weird sound is added in to, you know, I'm thinking about Evil Dead when, like, the camera is passing overhead, and every time there's a beam in the floor that passes the camera, you hear, like, womp, womp, womp. And there's some of that in Texas Chainsaw, which predates it by nearly a decade, where, you know, like when the hitchhiker cuts open Franklin's arm, you know, you don't hear like a slicing sound like we would hear in a movie today, or, you know.
No, you're a big.
Yeah, it's like a weird buzzing sound. It's like, what the hell is that? But it only serves to sort of unnerve we viewers just that much more.
What I also think that really adds to the movie, why I gravitated towards it when I was a kid, it was just the way the cinematography. I mean, you can take any image from that movie and it just looks amazing. I mean, the way the clouds look in Texas, the way the heat is rising up over the road when their van first comes over, And the way that everything just looks very authentic, like that the old house that they go into, and then the house where Leatherface and his family lives. It just looks, it looks like something you'll find in rural Texas.
Absolutely. And there is a weird sort of, I didn't realize it, I don't think, until this viewing. I mean, I've seen the movie over a dozen times in my life, but watching it this last time, I really noticed he employs a lot of like what we might consider like modern editing techniques in that movie. I mean, it was made in 73, 74, and yet, when you watch how he cuts together some of those montages, when you notice how he uses jump cuts that are kind of seamless, and you would never notice, like, when you're actually in the movie, you don't notice those little things. But watching it with more of a critical eye this time around, like, it's really impressive how he put that film together.
Oh, it's absolutely impressive. And the way the dolly, there's a lot of dolly shots. I mean, the one, the big one where Pam is on the slide and it goes underneath and the house gets bigger as she gets more towards it. But there are just so many, there's so many great angles of it. Like when they find the tooth, I always notice the shadows that are all over the porch. And when Jerry is walking towards the house and the sun looks humongous and it's just so orange and bright. It's just a really, really beautiful looking movie.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Pam shot and the dolly shot in that way, mentioning the house, because, I remember, I think it was around 2002, 2003, I was reading like Fangoria or Rue Morgue or something like that. And I think it was in an interview with Eli Roth, and he was talking about paying homage to that shot with Cabin Fever. But he talked about it as being the infamous ass shot from Texas Chainsaw. And, it was even replicated in the remake and was paid homage to in Eli Roth's Cabin Fever. And in both of those cases, the camera is sort of, focused entirely on the ladies. But if you look in Chainsaw, an attractive female form sort of dominates the frame. But the intent, I don't think, is to titillate. I mean, by putting that creepy old house in the background and having it loom over her, I think the intention was to sort of instill dread in viewers.
That's exactly what I got out of it. I mean, I don't. I mean, it's an ass shot, obviously, but the way that Hooper frames it, it's not like that. It's that she's getting closer towards her doom and towards the, as the house gets bigger and bigger and it's engulfing her as she walks towards it. And what really makes the shot for me work is the frame and the way, because I don't even look at her behind. I'm looking at the clouds that are overneath the, above the house and how they're just big and white, and then everything gets closer and closer as you move towards it. It's just an amazing shot. And they tried to do it in the remake, and it was just Jessica Biel, but there was nothing behind Jessica Biel. There was that big giant house, but there was just nothing. The sky wasn't engulfing us. The house wasn't bringing her towards her. She was just walking towards it. The same way in Cabin Fever, they were just walking. It's just like the camera's there, and it's like, oh, this is a butt shot, but there's nothing going on beyond the butt shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And it is, I don't think anybody has really replicated that shot in the way that Tobe Hooper meant for it to be. Like, I can't think of any other time that somebody paid homage to that shot and really nailed what it really was, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that happened right there on spot. That was just so, everything happened at the exact same time. Everything was right, and everything clicked, and it worked. Because I know they spent some time doing that shot, and it paid off. But there's a lot of great shots like that pay off in that movie. Like the way the van comes up over the hill, and it comes out of frame, and then we stay on the house, and it comes back into frame, and it parks right outside that house. That's an amazing shot. And it's simple, and the way even when the van leaves the gas station, you can see it pulls out and it goes down the gas station. But you got the gas station in the frame in the left. You got the big sky. You got the van driving off towards its doom. It's really wonderful filmmaking.
Absolutely. And it's something that I didn't really appreciate when I was a kid, even when I was getting into filmmaking and really trying to study, how movies were made and how they looked, and sort of appreciating, like even watching a Carpenter film, like seeing The Thing for the first time, it was chopped down to like full frame, but you could still tell that that's a beautiful movie. But for whatever reason, watching Texas Chainsaw the first time, I mean, of course, the first time I saw it, not only was it pan and scan, but, it was like the old media VHS that had been watched about 1,000 times at my local video store. But, You know, watching it, you just get the feeling that it's an ugly movie, that it's a gritty, grimy movie, and you're sort of put through the ringer. But, you know, when that first DVD came out, I think it was in the early aughts from, I think it was like Pioneer, and they had cleaned it up a little bit. It still looks nothing like the 4K restoration that was just done. But, you know, you look at that movie for the first time. It's, well, for me, it was like seeing it for the first time and realizing that Hooper had a hell of an eye, and he shot a really gorgeous movie.
Oh, yeah. It's like, it's really fantastic. And I mean, because we have HD here, we have an HD TV here that we got over the weekend, or like 2 weekends ago, and it was on, and I watched, and I was texting my friends. I'm like, man, this movie just looks really, really good. You forget how good it looks until you watch it again, and you're just like blown away.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago the sun sort of looming in one of the shots, and it is curious, watching the movie again, that Hooper opens the movie, nearly opens the movie, with those shots of the sunspots and the solar right. flares. And it, to me, almost it almost lends the movie this sort of kind of this apocalyptic feel right from the start, you know, and which is weird considering like he's cutting from bodies being uncovered from the earth and photographed to essentially, you know, these images in the heavens. And then we go right back from that to another corpse, only it's this time it's the armadillo. Right. On the road. And, you know, later on, we have a character looking over her horoscope. And, you know, the hitchhiker appears to be wearing a mojo bag around his neck. You know, there's a moment where he burns the picture of the group. He uses his blood to make a strange symbol on the side of the van. And, you know, for as gritty and realistic as the movie feels, there is that weird sense that there's almost like something grander and possibly supernatural happening beyond what we're seeing on screen, you know?
Well, yeah, I think that's when Pam's talking about it in the horoscopes in the van, she talks about Saturn in retrograde. And I think that's very much in the script. And that's very much, I think that's another theme that they're going with there, that the universe is all compounded and their doom is already, you know, it's already set in stone. That's what I thought they were always going with when as you get older and you start looking more into the movie, that they're, when she's talking about the stars lining up, she's basically talking about that everything's going to come down on them pretty soon and things are going to get bad. And speaking of the sun, it's like the scene, I'll go jump to the end when he's chased Sally and she gets in the truck and she drives off. But you take those sun flares and that early morning look out of that, it doesn't look as good. The sun flares just really add so much to that movie. It's just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, you know, I did a bit of reading the research for this talk, and you know, there was this interview where Hooper had noted that the solar flares and the mention of Saturn being in retrograde and retrogradation, you know, was his way of noting that. It was a way to reflect that the movie structurally is sort of constantly folding back in on itself, that no matter where the characters go in the film, you know, it's always the wrong way, which is kind of interesting. But, you know, I also found in the same interview, he noted that to him, the movie is almost about like possibly the horrors of the meat industry, you know, that the movie is about meat.
Yeah, which is very foreshadowing a lot. You know, you think that he's talking about stuff like that in the 70s, and now we're still talking about stuff like that. That meat's bad for you, and they add hormones, they add all these bad things to the meat that cause cancer. But yeah, it's exactly right. There's so much foreshadowing in the movie that because I think it's one of the first movies where, outside of Night of Living Dead, that it steps away from like being Frankenstein or werewolf or, you know, vampire, that it's actually real humans committing really violent acts.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it one of the first films? It's one of the first films that I can think of where, you know, we open with a group of youths who are on a trip and they eventually run afoul of an evil family or an evildoer of some sort. And I can't really, I mean, horror fans can look at that. And I mean, how many movies have been made based on that sort of very basic idea? It created an entire subgenre by itself.
Yeah, it has. It definitely has. It's such a simple premise too, you know? It's like they're going to see the house that they spent their summer vacation in, and then things go crazy and bad. It's very simple, but it's very well done. And the acting in the movie is really, really good. I mean, Marilyn Burns she could scream and she could really run. She was fantastic.
She's so great, and she's so real in the
real
show.
Like when she tied to that chair, you're like, man, she is. It's because you see a lot of people who are tied to chairs and you're just like, I don't believe these people at all. But she was like really authentic. I mean, when Pam gets when she runs out of the house and when she goes into the bone room and she starts coughing, and you really feel her agony there. It's just amazing job.
Absolutely. And I've always maintained that I think Marilyn Burns is probably my favorite final girl. But also, I mean, is she the first?
And Amy Steele and Jamie Lee Curtis are pretty much tied for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to beat Laurie Strode from Halloween. I mean, definitely. Yeah. But it's crazy. I mean, is Marilyn Burns, do you think, is Sally Hardesty like the original final girl? Or would you go back further to something like, say, Psycho? I mean, would Lila Crane count as a final girl? I don't know that I would say that, but I can't think of anyone else who might.
You'd have to go Sally, because she's, I mean, you think of the final girl that she goes through all this hell and high water, and then she finally gets away at the end. And that's exactly what happens to her. She gets on the back of that truck, and, you know, she's the final girl, all bloody. And that's how we remember our final girls, bloody, worn out, and tired.
Which is crazy to think. I mean, you look at the movie, I mean, she does go through absolute hell. And it's not really, even for her having escaped at the end, it's not really a happy ending, because the movie makes it clear, I think, that she has completely lost her mind in those final frames. But, you know, looking back at the movie, the violence against the men in the movie is relatively quick. I mean, a quick hammer to the head, you know, much like, you know, Hitchhiker talking about, you know, the cows being put down. Whereas the violence perpetrated against the women is sort of protracted in a way. I mean, poor Pam is hung up on a meat hook, and then she is thrown in a freezer. And then we don't really know what her fate is after that, but we can guess it's probably not great. And, you know, the entire final third of the movie, I think, is devoted to torturing poor Sally. But, you know, I got to wonder, I don't think I would charge this movie with being misogynistic, but, you know, it is curious to wonder about, you know, the fact that the women are put through so much more hell, and that, you know, I mean, sure, Sally is kind of a final girl in a way, but even saying that, I mean, it's worth noting, I think, that it is two men who wind up saving her at the end, even though, you know, one of them runs away.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever happened to the trucker?
I got to think he's still running all these years later. I know I would never stop after seeing that.
I think what I really liked about it was when the whole chase of Sally, I mean, that's the longest possibly chase we've ever had in a horror movie. I mean, she goes through the woods all the way to the house, goes up the house, sees, then jumps out the window, runs all the way back through the woods, and then goes, you know, and then finally empties into the gas station again. And I just thought that was, I think that's a really great scene.
Absolutely. And so beautifully shot too. Again, with those jump cuts too. I mean, she's in profile in the distance, and we move to a medium shot, and then we move to a close-up, all without cutting back to Leatherface. And then when we do, it's the same thing with him. And it sort of, it leaves you unbalanced in a way. And I wonder if it was just Hooper attempting to stretch out what footage he had to make the chase seem much longer than it actually was, or if he was, I mean, I got to imagine, given how well-crafted the rest of the movie is, I mean, that was yet another trick that he used to sort of keep audiences off balance during, you know, really intense sequence.
I mean, you look at that scene when she runs to the house and how the house is, you know, in the background and the way it's lit. And it's just a great scene, because she enters the frame, she's running towards the house, and all of a sudden Leatherface is right behind her. And what I always liked about it is when she goes up the stairs, she sees she sees Grandma and the dead, I guess it's Grandma. And then she comes back down, and the way it's intercut with him slicing the door and her revelation of that she's in this house of horrors is just, it's just phenomenal. And the way that the score is, like, it keeps doing those high shrieking piano wire things. It's just really, it's great.
Oh, God. And plus, when she runs down the stairs, when she realizes there's no salvation in that house, and she goes back down the same way she came, only to find him waiting for her at the bottom of the stairs. It's just ratcheting up that tension constantly.
His reaction to her is really great too. He's like, oh, there she is, you know. He almost catches him off guard, and that's his, Gunnar Hansen's portrayal of Leatherface is something that's never been duplicated. It's a lot like the first Michael Myers. They're just the way they move, and I mean, he is his own person, and he gives him a life, and he doesn't really utter a single syllable, and he's just really terrifying, but yet unique in a different way.
Yeah, and all through body language, I mean, he creates a character that we feel in a weird way. I mean, he is never anything but terrifying, but at the same time, he's oddly sympathetic in a way because, you know, there's that moment after he kills the third member of our group, and he starts racing through the house looking around like mad, and he runs to the window and looks out, and he sits down, and he almost puts his head in his hands, and, you know, you get the feeling that mentally there is a handicap there, like he is not a fully developed human being. He's not a malevolent force wearing a mask. He's somebody who has been shaped, you know. But I mean, there is a sort of comedy to it, too, in a way, where that look on his face when he's just shaking his head, he gets feeling that, you know, where the hell are these people coming from? How many more do I have to contend with?
And how'd they get that chicken in that little cage?
Oh, God, yeah. I felt bad for that thing.
That's something you get. And those real bones, I love the when I was reading the book there, I read about the production designer and how they would go along and they'd go to animal graveyards and get like real bones, which is something you just can't do today.
Yeah, that set must have been hell. I mean, you think about how hot that summer must have been when they shot, and then the fact that they're coated in fake blood. And
you ever been to Texas in the summer? It is not fun.
I was there. I took a trip and I had a connecting flight there, and I spent about 10 minutes outside in August, and I was like, I could never live here.
And then, you know, compiled, they probably had lights blasting into that little room, the dinner scene room, and I was, you know, over 100 degrees. I just don't know why. Why did they choose? Whenever I meet Hooper, I want to ask him, why did you choose? Why don't you just get an old man to play an old man instead of putting old man makeup on a young kid? I thought that was kind of funny.
Would he have known the conditions he was going to be shooting in well in advance? In which case, I don't know that an old man would have been able to survive.
No, I don't think so either.
Because wasn't that the dinner table sequence?
Yeah.
I think they shot over the course of like 18 hours, something like that.
Yeah, it was. I think it was 21 hours.
Oh, God.
So, that's a long time to shoot.
And plus, I mean, the fact that everyone was going a little mad on that set, too. I mean, there is that great, you know, oft-told story about Gunnar Hansen getting fed up with the blood tube not working at one point, and so he used a real knife to cut open Marilyn Burns' finger to feed Grandpa. Well, I mean,
they also were talking about pot brownies, too. I think they were eating pop brownies.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I read, is that when he chases her up the stairs, it took like hours and hours because everybody was high on pop brownies.
Meanwhile, he probably had an actual live working chainsaw in his hands.
Absolutely. I think they took the chain off back then. I think that's where I read that they had to chase the chain off, but I don't know. They probably used a real one. Funny, but like right when I did Right to Spring, my first movie, Texas was a really big influence on me by using the because all the locations in Texas and the way to use the environment to help your movie look a little bit bigger and better.
Well, there's something about Texas too. I mean, whenever it's portrayed in film, there's this notion that there are so many wide open spaces you can buy that people could get lost there and then just get swallowed up by the landscape. And, you know, it's the same thing with, you know, with our heroes in Texas Chainsaw when they're driving in that van. I mean, it just, you know, you just know that doom is impending because they're so cut off from the rest of the world at certain points. And of course, I mean, you know, there is that great moment where they're in the van early on and they drive by a slaughterhouse and we intercut between our heroes and the cattle who are being led to the slaughter. And it's a very smart sort of nod to what's going to happen.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah, and the movie does that. I think Hooper weaves in all of these subtle signs of danger lurking about leading all the way up until the big reveal of Leatherface with the hammer in his hand. But, you know, I'm thinking of the spiders crawling over each other in a house, or the dried up swimming hole, or the watch with a nail through it dangling, you know, with all of those other items from the tree. You know, all of those shots sort of, it continually ratchets up the tension until, you know, the movie explodes. And it's so smart in a way how he does that.
I read that you go back to the nail in the clock. I read that there was a scene that was supposed to be in the movie of they stumble upon this campsite where people got slaughtered with, like, there was a tent and there was a sleeping bag and everything like that. I read something like that. That's where that nail in the clock thing came from.
That's really interesting. You know, speaking of like little nods and foreshadowing, we even have Franklin early on, you know, when he sees the hitchhiker for the first time, and he says, I think we just picked up Dracula. Yeah. And then, you know, he hears that he has a family, and he's like, a whole family of Draculas. But, you know, the notion of bloodsuckers, I mean, isn't too far removed from cannibals. I wonder if that was meant to be more foreshadowing, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of foreshadowing in it. The more you watch it, the more you pick up everything.
And can we talk about how unbelievably sympathetic, or rather unsympathetic, Franklin is? Like, he's a character
the worst,
that,
isn't he? The worst.
Oh my God, he's a character that we should feel for. I mean, he's put in this really terrible situation. By all accounts, he was dragged along. He didn't really even want to go. He's in a wheelchair, so he's handicapped. And he's the guy that we should feel bad for. But my God, you just want him to get offed as quickly as possible.
Yeah, when he's complaining about the key, they took the keys. It's like, you're just like, oh God, can you just kill this guy already, please? but he's annoying from like the get go.
Oh, from moment one.
As soon as he falls down the hill in the from the truck, you're just like, oh God, they should just leave him down there. But what's so interesting about him is that he is a very interesting character, and it's weird that they wanted to play him like that. I thought they would want us to be sympathetic towards him, and we're just not at all.
I don't want to speak ill of the man. I think it's Paul Partain who played Franklin, but I wonder how much of that was perhaps his own personality, or at least, you know, if not his own personality, then perhaps his bag of tricks as a performer that went into Franklin to make him that way, because he also had a very small role in a great 70s movie called Rolling Thunder.
Yeah, he was at the dinner, or at the scene where Tommy Lee Jones comes in.
Yeah, he's like, he's...
the brother, I think.
John's brother or brother-in-law, yeah. I forget which. But he's, you know, when he's talking to his dad about wanting a smoke, you know, and...
He was annoying in that movie, too, just like for a quick second, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, I wonder how much of it was just him. You know, maybe Franklin was meant to be sympathetic and they just cast the wrong guy.
I think that's the case. I think he might have been... because I read stories that none of the cast really liked him. But I don't know. But I find his character very funny, very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And it does allow for a little bit of levity early on, even as the tension is getting ratcheted up. I mean, you know, the scene where he rolls into the old Hardesty homestead, you know, and he's sort of screeching on about how he didn't want to be there. And then he starts, like, you know, raspberrying the room, like no one around to hear him. But he's like, you know, stuff like that. It's like, my God, it's you hate him, but it is kind of funny in a way. And then, you know, that thread is sort of picked up later on with the Sawyer family. Even though things are intense and horrifying, there is that weird vein of dark humor that sort of runs throughout.
It's very dark humor. The way they bicker among each other is very family oriented, you know, and the way that the hitchhiker does interacts with the Jim character, the old man, it's very funny.
Yeah, and yet it only adds to, at that point, it doesn't really lighten the mood at all. It only makes it more unnerving at that point, because we're laughing and we know we shouldn't be laughing because, you know, our heroine is in, you know, mortal danger, but at the same time it is kind of funny.
Yeah, because they're calling each other names. Hog bitch, I think. I don't know if I can say it on a podcast.
No, please.
Yeah, and you know, and they it's just, yeah, the way they yell at each other, and the way, look what your brother did, the door is a great line.
Yeah, that's the thing that he's concerned about. They're about to murder a poor woman, but I mean, he's going to have to replace a door.
Well, yeah, he's got to replace a door. His electricity is very expensive. He's got a lot of things to worry about.
You know, yeah, it's crazy to look at that movie and see those family members and realize that, I think, you know, there are aspects of each of them, you know, the hitchhiker and Leatherface and the cook and maybe not Grandpa, but, you know, they're all sort of derived in ways from Ed Gein, the real...
Yeah.
Well, Ed Gein wasn't really a serial killer, but he was definitely a murderer and a grave robber. And, you know, his exploits not only inspired Texas Chainsaw, but also, you know, Psycho and Deranged and, you know, the Buffalo Bill character in Silence of the Lambs. And, but I think, you know, just reading about Gein, it feels like, you know, you can see how he inspired those other movies, but in its own way, even though it's the most fantastic in a way, I think Texas Chainsaw is the movie that sort of is closest to the reality in a way.
I think it takes it to a whole new level. I mean, you have the psycho character, which, you know, he digs up his mom, and he, you know, and, but you, the Texas, they make bone furniture out of people. You know, they eat people, they make bone furniture out of people. That's pretty, and they rob graves, and they have these awesome designs on the graves, and like strap these skeleton bodies on top of big cemetery stones. Yeah, so I think they take it to a next level. And I love that you mentioned Deranged. Deranged doesn't get as much love as it should.
Oh, it's great. Who's the lead character and the actor? Was it Roberts Blossom, I think?
I'm not sure. I think you're right.
Such a great performance. And he's so unhinged in that, you know, when you read about Ed Gein, there is something that's sort of sad about him. Like, he is a character to kind of be pitied, even though he was dangerous and even though he did murder two people. And I think years later, they actually did make an Ed Gein film starring, I've forgotten his name, Stephen Railsback.
Yeah.
I think. Too. And, you know, he played Gein as being kind of an oddly sympathetic character. Whereas, you know, you watch Deranged and.
It's Robert Blossom, by the way.
Oh, okay. And, you know, that guy is terrifying in a way.
Yeah, but it's so. And you look at Deranged and you look at Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They're two different movies, but you can see the art and the craft in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, as opposed to a movie like Deranged. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
It's almost like comparing Halloween to like
Halloween Resurrection.
Halloween Resurrection. Yeah.
Sorry, I will never miss an opportunity to bash Resurrection.
Like,
I apologize.
This is a work of art. This is
exploitation at best.
Yeah, exploitation at best.
Yeah, but it is, you know, crazy to think that all of those movies sort of poured forth from the same source material. You know, it's weird to think that Psycho and Texas Chainsaw shared DNA.
Yeah, yeah, it's strange. And the other thing, going back to the look of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I haven't really seen any movies that look like that. I know they shot it. Somebody asked me once, they're like, hey, if you would ever do a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, what would you do? And I was like, I would shoot it like the one in 1974. I'd shoot it on 16mm, the Eclair. I think they used the Eclair. And I would try to emulate the way that looked. And there's not a lot of movies that look like that. I would say maybe Easy Rider. Easy Rider has that same feel. And that's about it.
Yeah, I don't know why, but when I saw it for the first time, I mean, both movies are set in Texas, and one movie is shot in 235 and looks gorgeous. But in a weird way, No Country for Old Men sort of reminds me of the feel, like the tone of Texas Chainsaw, in a weird way.
Yeah, it's a little bit more. It's the 30. It just looks like a big movie, where Texas seems still small, but it still looks. It still has that. There's something about the film print, some of the way the film looks in the 70s looks great. Like Rolling Thunder looks a lot like that. Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre has that light, that little grainy feel to it.
That's a great looking movie too.
Yeah, that's a wonderful movie. That's a whole nother podcast on that movie.
Okay. Yeah, I love that film, and it doesn't get the credit it sort of deserves. And it's not for lack of people trying. Like, you know, I remember Tarantino named his distribution company back in the mid-90s Rolling Thunder, and you would think that would have shined a light on it. And then he talked about it later on. And then Showtime Extreme back in the early aughts, you know, started running it. And the damn thing is on Blu-ray now, looking gorgeous with bonus features. And you actually have Tommy Lee Jones and William Devane doing new interviews for it. And yet, it's still not talked about as often as it should be, I don't think.
I like it better than Taxi Driver. I mean, it's one of those movies where it's also had one of the greatest box covers when you were a kid. That and The Exterminator probably had the best box covers, where you would go, oh, I got to rent that movie just for the box cover alone. And it's just a very, very powerful movie. And Devane is so good in it. And I don't think he's been that good. I mean, he was great in Marathon Man. And he's pretty bad in Breaking Training. But he's fantastic.
I just want to know, like, I'm going off on a weird tangent here, but why not? As good a performance as he gave in that, you know, you would think that somebody would sort of come along and give him, like, you know, I'm thinking of somebody like Tarantino reviving his career by giving him that one role that you know, only he can do. And damn it, like, he deserves it. You know, he's still capable of that, if not better now.
Yeah, that I always wondered, like, why didn't people, you know, want to put him in another role? You know what I mean? Like today, like, he's such a great actor, and all of his movies are just, I know he does a lot of TV work. So, because he wasn't he on 24? He was, I think he plays James Heller on 24.
I think so. Wasn't he like the president or something?
Yeah,
some point?
I think he might have been the president on 24.
Very cool. But yeah, Rolling Thunder.
James Heller.
Yeah, listeners out there, if you haven't seen Rolling Thunder, it's available for cheap on a great Blu-ray. Definitely check that movie out. It's one of the best revenge movies ever. It's one of the best movies about Vietnam. I can't say enough good things about it. So.
Yeah, and he had a great run there. He had he had Marathon Man. I think he was in Family Plot, and I think Rolling Thunder, all within like a year of each other. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I it's funny. I just mentioned Vietnam in relation to Rolling Thunder, and it's crazy. I remember reading ages ago, it's around the time that I probably saw Texas Chainsaw for the very first time, where somebody noted that they felt as though the movie was almost in a weird way a sort of allegory for Vietnam. You know, the notion of this machine in the heartland just sort of chewing up the youth. And, you know, I don't know if I completely see that, you know, in the movie.
Don't you think it's kind of reaching?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I can imagine that informing the feel of the movie. But then again, you know, when we get to that prequel we talked about, the prequel to the remake, I mean, they actually make that sort of concrete in a way by having one of the characters being a potential draft dodger.
Yeah.
But it is curious that, you know, the franchise sort of eventually touched on that in such a way, you know.
Well, and part two, his characters returned from Vietnam. Chop Top.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. How did I forget Chop Top?
You can't forget Chop Top. Chop Top's like, who you like better, Hitchhiker or Chop Top?
There you go. Brother. They're the perfect characters for their movies. I don't think Chop Top would work in the first movie, and I don't think the Hitchhiker would work in the second.
But he's still good in the second movie. It's just like that whole scene in the that's my dog going crazy. That whole scene in the radio is just fantastic. It's really, really a wonderful scene.
Absolutely. And it's crazy. You know, we were talking about the dark humor that's sort of threaded throughout the first movie. I mean, that really comes to the fore in the second film. You know, it's almost a farce at points, and yet in its own way it's still completely unnerving too. It's just it feels like the mix between horror and comedy has shifted between films. But
and Hooper's one of my favorite directors. He's such a his films are almost bordering on falling apart. All his movies tend to like almost like not work, but they work really, really well. Like, I'm a huge fan of the Funhouse.
Oh yeah,
Salem's Lot. I love Eaten Alive. I think Eaten Alive is awesome. And
Eaten Alive is great. And it looks amazing too. I mean, it's gritty and realistic.
I know it's set, and I know, but I just love the way it looks and the way it feels. And Marilyn does a great performance in that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought she was a very underutilized character in the 70s. I thought she should have been bigger than she actually was, because she's wonderful.
Absolutely. I mean, she did want, it was Texas Chainsaw and she was great in it. She gives a hell of a performance in Eaten Alive. She played, is that Linda Kasabian in, you know, Helter Skelter.
Like, Helter Skelter, yep.
You know, she gave solid performance after solid performance, and she was beautiful. I mean, it is curious that her career never went much higher than that, which is a shame. I feel the same way about Rolling Thunder, not only Devane, but, you know, the lead actress in that, Linda.
Yeah, she didn't really do anything after, you know, that much at all. I think she was on Charlie's Angels, I think.
Yeah, there was that, and I think she was in Coffee, and she was in, she was in a great exploitation movie. I forget what it's called. My mind is failing me today, but she did a handful of things, and then she sort of just disappeared, which is a shame because she was brilliant, too.
She was fantastic.
You know, we talked about one and two and having that weird sort of vein of dark humor. Do you think that that's something that sort of carried over from film to film throughout the franchise, or do you feel like they kind of lost that as the franchise went on?
I think they kind of lost it as the franchise went on. I think Leatherface is really, really underrated as well.
That's great. It's like a splatterpunk movie. I think it's the closest to being a celluloid splatterpunk movie. You know, I'm talking about like the literary movement back in like the 90s or whatever. It felt like, and maybe having David Scowl write the script for Leatherface is part of that, but I can't think of any other movie that sort of felt like that at that time, you know?
Yeah, I really liked it a lot. I thought the I don't know if they were going for the black humor in the remake in the I know there's nothing in the beginning. I don't know if the cop was supposed to be black humor, but I thought they kind of lost that a little bit. And I think my main problem is that with remakes is that they always try to explain the violence instead of just letting the violence. This is what these people do. You know, I don't want to know their backstory. I don't know where they came from. You know, I just want to. I think it makes a character scarier. And that's what's so scary about the first one is that they go to this house looking for gas, and they just pick the wrong house. A lot like Last House on the Left, they just, you know, they pick the wrong guys to get drugs from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I did mention that I like the Platinum Dunes movies, and I really dug that prequel. But at the same time, it felt like the prequel existed to explain everything that we saw in the previous film.
Yeah, like the guy's leg getting cut off, all that stuff that we, you know, you really don't need. I mean, I really liked the, what I really liked about the prequel, the beginning, Texas Chainsaw Massacre beginning, it was the look of it. I think it's got the best look next to the original
I agree.
for me, the way it looks, and it's a very very easy on the eyes, and it looks very beautiful and unique. And that's what I liked about it. I think it's the same guy who did the Tooth Fairy. Isn't it the same guy who did the Tooth Fairy? Or Darkness Falls, I mean.
Yeah. And then he went on to do Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, there
Weird
you go.
career.
Hey, what's the alien invasion movie you did?
Oh, did he do that? Was it Battle Los Angeles or was it Skyline?
No, he did Battle Los Angeles.
Okay,
Yeah,
cool.
another
Yeah, I
good looking movie.
yeah, he's a hell of a shooter, and I agree the prequel definitely looked great. It did look beautiful in the way that the remake did, but you're right, it had some of that griminess and some of that grittiness that the original 74 film had, I think.
Yeah, it reminded me of Halloween 2, the Rob Zombie sequel, where the sequel was actually better than the remake.
I agree entirely. I think Halloween 2 is one of the best movies of the last 15 years, and I get people looking at me like I'm crazy whenever I say that, but I think it's brilliant.
The first 20 minutes, dude, is like off the charts good. It is like really good. And then once Laurie wakes up with the Manson poster hanging over him, I get kind of lost. But the opening is possibly one of the best openings of a Halloween franchise by far.
I loved it. I even loved what they did with Laurie. It was one of those things that I always kind of wanted to see as a horror fan where, you know, in most sequels, whenever, you know, somebody goes through heinous events from the previous movie, either it takes place 1 minute later and they're still in that sort of agitated state. You know, I'm thinking about the original Halloween 2, say, or, you know, it's a year later, 2 years later, something like that. And these people who should have post-traumatic stress disorders are like, you know, they're pretty much okay. You know, I mean, they might be a little bit wary. They might, you know, look around a corner before they step into a hallway or something. They might be expecting a killer here or there, you know, especially as the events of the sequel sort of intensify. But what I loved about Zombies Halloween 2 is the fact that he focused on a final girl post-horror movie. You know, there are stretches of that movie that are just about her life, and it really sort of focuses on somebody who lived through a really traumatic event and are doing their best to sort of deal with it. And I love that film for that.
Yeah, but I wouldn't. The Manson stuff throws me. It's like, okay, you just got destroyed by a serial killer. Now you wake up and you're hanging Manson posters in your room. It just sort of doesn't make it much sense to me.
I think that worked for me. I dug that, and I completely understand somebody disagreeing with that because it is weird and it does feel like a very
It's
zombie
just
thing to
very
do.
rough zombie thing to do.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, I kind of get, you know, much in the same way that, you know, as a kid, I was terrified by, you know, Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees. But, you know, by the time Halloween came around, guess what I'm doing? I'm dressing up as Freddy Krueger or Michael Myers or, you know, whatnot. So I think in a way almost Laurie, that was her way of dealing with all the horror that she had been through, was sort of owning it in a way and like immersing herself in it in a strange way. And I don't know if that's viable. I don't know if that's realistic in a way, but I think for his universe that he created, I sort of believe that that's where Laurie would go.
I think if you cut Dr. Loomis out of that movie, I'm trying to get my buddy to do an edit where you just cut him out of the entire movie.
Would he just show up at the end to save Laurie?
That I think it'd be pretty wonderful. But I loved the first 20 minutes of it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it is. Have you seen the director's cut of it?
No, I have not seen the director's cut, but I should watch it. I'll probably watch it this Halloween.
Very, very different ending. But yeah, I agree with you too about the look of that movie. And I think, you know, the first
film. That was shot on Super 16.
Yeah. It was 16 millimeter, which is crazy considering that, you know, I think it's even like 1.85 that he shot in, whereas, you know, the previous movie was 35 millimeter. It was 2.35. It was as close to Carpenter as he could get, I think. And I wonder if that's not part of the reason that his Halloween doesn't work so much for me is because I actually love the first hour of his Halloween. It feels the most him, and it feels like
it definitely a Rob Zombie movie where you sort of, there's no character who, I mean, the first minute or the first couple minutes we meet Laurie Strode, she's putting a finger in a bagel. So she's not that innocent. And a lot of my problems with his movies is that a lot of his characters aren't really relatable. There are sort of like comic book dropping F-bombs type characters that just don't appeal to me.
Have you seen 31 yet?
Pardon?
Have you seen 31 yet?
Yeah, my friend's asking me. He goes, "Hey, you want to go see 31 this Friday?" I'm like, "No, but I'm gonna go see Blair Witch instead."
Very cool. It suffers from that a little bit. I mean, it's, you know, like a lot of his movies, it sort of looks great in a way, and I think the guy has a hell of an eye. And
yeah,
you know,
Lords of Salem is my favorite movie by him.
It looks beautiful. And the way he can cut montages to, like, you know, the sort of songs that he needle drops throughout the movies. Yeah. You know, 31 has a sequence at the end of it that's just sort of incredible. But, you know, even with The Devil's Rejects or arguably House of a Thousand Corpses or his two Halloween movies, I can always find at least one character that I find likable enough to take that journey with. And 31 doesn't quite have that. They're all kind of a little bit cardboard cutouts of characters, which is kind of
what I do like about him, though, is that he definitely has his own world. I mean, that's the Rob Zombie world. This is what you're getting when you make a Rob Zombie film, whether you like it or not. But that's what I strive for as a filmmaker, where people watch my movies and go, "Oh, that's a Patrick Reynolds movie," or "Hey, that's a, you know, Toby Hooper movie." That's the way the look and the way the universe you set up. I mean, Tarantino, you know a Tarantino movie within the first, you know, couple frames just by the dialogue alone.
Absolutely.
And whether you hate zombie or not, you sort of, either you're on board with his universe or you're not, you know,
which is
very admirable. That's the way you should be as a filmmaker. This is my world. If you don't like it, hit the road.
Which is crazy. Out of all the remakes he might have done, he winds up with Halloween, which is a series that is known for its sort of, you know, when Carpenter started it out, it was about precision, you know, and his scares are more akin to somebody operating with a scalpel, whereas Zombie is a little more of a sledgehammer kind of guy. And not in a bad way. I'm not knocking him for that. But how was it that he never did a Texas Chainsaw movie?
It's like, if you're going to give a franchise to a guy, give Texas Chainsaw to Rob Zombie. Don't give him Halloween, where it's Halloween's a little bit more, you know, spooky. You know, we really don't know who the shape is. He's lurking here and there. Where Texas Chainsaw Massacre just bam, force over your head all the time, you know?
Absolutely. And I guess the argument could be made that House of a Thousand Corpses was kind of his Texas Chainsaw in a way.
Yeah. But if you know, if I was somebody, that's what I would say. If I was relaunching, I know the people who did Livid and the people who did Inside are doing the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I think they're pretty good choices. I really like their movies a lot.
Yeah, I've only seen Inside. I haven't been able to catch their other films because they're not available here.
But Livid, man. That's the problem. They always make movies that aren't available here.
There's another one that they just made recently that I think it came out like... did it come out like a year or two ago? Something like that. That sounds amazing, but it's nowhere to be found here in the States.
Among the Living. It's one of those Mandy Lane things where it just disappears and you don't get to see it for like 10 years. I mean, Livid's great. I saw Livid. I got the chance to see Livid at a festival and I just thought it was fantastic. I was like, wow, these guys. And there's a really cool Halloween 3 nod, wink, wink thing in there. I kind of like a lot what they did with the Adam Wingard movie. What's it called? The Guest.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, they're great filmmakers, so I'm excited to see what they do with the franchise. But I know it's been a while since they shot it, so let's hope for the best.
Now, I gotta ask, as a filmmaker, would you be interested in tackling a property like Texas Chainsaw?
I wrote a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie.
Really?
Like, when I first started out as a writer, I'm like, okay, I really like these franchises. I'm just going to write. I wrote a Texas Chainsaw Massacre one. I wrote a Halloween remake, and I wrote a Hell Night remake. And that's just sitting around. But I really like my Texas Chainsaw Massacre take. I thought it was pretty cool and pretty crazy.
Now, would it be okay? Can I ask you just even vaguely what your chainsaw take would have been?
Yeah, it's more. They kind of explored a lot in Hills of Ice 2, the remake. It's that the family needs people to breed because their family's dying, so they kidnap these girls and they impregnate them. And these kids stumble upon their house, and we find the mother. There's a new mother there. It's a lot. You ever see the Peacock Family episode from The X-Files?
Yes. Is it Home? I think.
Yeah, it's a lot like that.
Oh wow, and that's a. That's an incredibly disturbing episode too.
Yeah, and it's got a really cool opening, and it also has this guy looking for his brother who went missing, but the brother went missing with something that this guy he needs. He's actually not his brother, so it's a little simple plan thrown in there as well.
Oh, that's very cool. Now I got to ask, which would this be like full on reboot, or would you want to tie it into the one of the? Am I getting this wrong? Are there three timelines now when it comes to the Chainsaw franchise?
I titled the Texas Chainsaw Massacre '95. It takes place in '95.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, so it would just be part of the canon of the family. That's what's so great about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies is I think you can do. Then it's not like Michael Myers because they have a big family. So you could do one in 95, you could do one in 2000, you could do one, you could do one in 88. You know, it's just that's what I is so great about it. I think you can do them at any time.
Yeah, and it is curious. I mean, all he needs is a family of some sort. And there were those nods in the first Leatherface that seemed to hint that there is a sort of community of these people that live across Texas. And then of course, you know, the very next movie, The Next Generation goes full on batshit by having that weird scarified tribal tattooed FBI agent who checks in with the family. And it's a project to instill fear. It's like, what the fuck is going on?
I was so terribly excited about that movie too. And then when I saw it finally on VHS, I was like, whoop, God, what the hell is going on in this movie?
Yeah. I was the first guy to rent that at my local video store. Like I kept calling them and pestering them to see when it was going to come in because I couldn't wait to see it. And I'm like, look, Fangoria tells me this thing is due out this week. Please tell me you have this thing already. And then, I couldn't wait to watch it. And 10 minutes in, I was just kind of like, oh no.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it's like when you're watching The Phantom Menace. You're like, oh no, I've waited so long for this.
I will say, the one thing about The Next Generation, I'll give props to. I think McConaughey is great in it. I've always said, McConaughey's performance as Vilmer is just kind of incredible.
Zellweger's pretty good too. She's pretty good in it.
Yeah, it's funny, like they released that movie so many years after it was made and those two were already stars. And I think they were banking on that to sort of like help carry the movie to some sort of success. And of course, it wound up just going straight to VHS. But after watching it, I'm like, you know, you look at McConaughey and I think he is really great. And I think I was a little disappointed with Renee Zellweger because she's been, you know, I was a fan of hers. I still am. But, you know, she didn't feel as special in a way, or she didn't stand out from the other cast members in the way that McConaughey did.
Right.
Which you would expect from somebody who only two or three years later became a bona fide star, but.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy though. Those two are in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. It's pretty wild.
I saw McConaughey on, was it the Tonight Show, I think, or maybe Jimmy Kimmel or something like that. And it was this weird bit where he worked in a video store. He was chatting.
Oh, yeah, I saw that too.
Yeah, and he noted that his chainsaw was the third Texas Chainsaw movie, and it's like he doesn't even know which number he was in.
Going back to Leatherface is so underrated. That was a movie where I didn't have really high hopes for it. I liked the Excalibur teaser trailer that they released.
Oh, yeah.
As a kid. And then when I saw it in theaters, I was like, wow, that's a pretty good movie. That's pretty decent.
Yeah, it was the first one I ever saw, and I didn't really know much about that franchise. All I knew is that my brother loved it, and he was about 6 years older than me, and I was still a kid, and I wound up sneaking and watching it one night, and it scared the hell out of me. But,
all the big lights coming on. That's a really cool, and the little girl was great.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a shame, though. I mean, the movie as it exists is sort of cut to hell. I mean, I know there's that unrated cut, but by all accounts, that's even, you know, that's not even really Jeff Burr's director's cut, which is a shame. Right. Because, I mean, some of those scenes are cut together in such a way that you can't even tell what's happening. Like when, I forget his name, but the would-be hero of the movie, when he's strung upside down, you know, it took me watching the unrated cut to finally figure out that he's killed by a sledgehammer that's released, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's so cut to hell in the original R-rated cut. But what's crazy is there was a comic book line in the early 90s. I think it was North Star.
Was that Ken Forey?
No. Although he is killed in the unrated cut too.
I think Kate Hodge is the... Is it William Butler? I don't know.
William Butler, yes. I can't think of his character's name.
My brain is frozen today.
Same here. Yeah, when he is when the hooks are put through his ankles and he's strung up, you know, in the R-rated cut, you get the feeling that something bad happens to him because of the character's reactions. But, yeah, it's not until the unrated cut that you realize that he is he's done in by a sledgehammer that's sort of let loose and sort of collides with his head. But what's crazy is they're there was this comic book company called, I believe, North Star, and they were doing a line of Texas Chainsaw books, and it started with a film adaptation of, or rather an adaptation of the film Leatherface in comic book form. It was only 4 issues, but it was unbelievably grisly. Like, you can tell that they just looked at David Scow's script and just went nuts with illustrating all the crazy gore and stuff. And you read that comic, and then you compare it to the film, and it's like, this movie never would have gotten an R. Like, you can understand why they had to cut it. It's just a shame that, again, Burr's
directed. Is this online?
I don't know. I don't know if it is or not.
I'll have to look it up when we get off. Because I always wonder about, like, you know, what gets cut out of, because I have the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre script, and I always wonder what gets cut out of movies. I'm always fascinated by that, by reading scripts. Like Halloween 2, there was a whole chase inside this little... going off subject, sorry.
No, please, go ahead.
But there's in Halloween 2, Laurie goes into this room that's all like wheelchairs and crutches, and he's walking through this crutches like hanging from the wall. It's a really cool scene.
Huh, that sounds awesome. Yeah, I'm sort of fascinated by that stuff too. I grew up with VHS, of course, and the notion of you know, laser discs were still kind of new, but I would read in Fangoria, you know, the notion of like deleted scenes being made available to view. And it's like, what? That's incredible. Well, stuff that was made that didn't go into the movie, but you can still watch it somewhere. And now people shrug, you know, at bonus features on DVDs, which is kind of a shame. But
also in Halloween 2, the script, Michael gets in the trunk of the reporter's car. You know how they spend so much time with the reporter? I wonder if they shot that. And then he kills the reporter when he gets out of the trunk.
Really?
Yeah. And that he gets in. That's how he gets to the hospital in the script.
Huh. That's kind of interesting. Yeah,
kind of interesting. I wonder if they shot that and then it didn't work, and then Carpenter reshot the whole him walking to the hospital.
Ah, very possible. That would be interesting. Yeah, I wonder how much stuff was cut out of, you know, the original Chainsaw, like stuff that they shot and didn't use, or perhaps stuff that they had to forego shooting because of, you know, restrictions to their budget or time or whatnot.
Probably. There's always that still that always fascinates me, where Leatherface is running from the house with the windmills behind him and the house is behind him, and he's running down the driveway. So that has to be a still from the movie, right?
I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, so that I always wondered about that, if they shot, you know, a shot of him running down running down the driveway by himself.
Could be. Yeah. Could be. Such an iconic character. I hope that the new movie that's coming up, I think also called Leatherface, I'm hoping that it winds up being great and sort of redeems the franchise.
Yeah, I think all of them need a nice redeeming. And I know people bag on it, like we don't need any more of them, but it's like, why not? They're there. Let's use them. I mean, we're still getting vampire movies. We're still getting werewolf movies.
Yeah, why not those guys? And plus, you know, if nothing else, let's send them out on a high note, because unfortunately, a lot of the icons that we grew up with are... they're kind of hurting in a way. Like, I don't want the last time we see Freddy Krueger to be that remake. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I know they're going to be, I think they're going to reboot that. I think they're trying to reboot it. And I know that Friday the 13th has to shoot soon because they have tax stuff here. I think they're going to shoot it in California.
It is crazy to think, too. I think Leatherface was actually announced a couple of years ago. But, I mean, is it shot? Is it not? I remember seeing photos
from it.
But
it's done.
I just wonder what they're waiting on. Like, I want to see something. I want to see some sort of iconic character hit screens again soon.
Right. Yeah, I do, too. I think we get Blair Witch this weekend, which is really, really cool.
I can't wait.
Looking forward to that a lot. Those guys are great writers. Simon's a great writer. And then I think we're probably going to get a Friday the 13th movie here pretty soon, coming up soon, too, which is good. Because I love the remake. I thought the remake was great.
Remake was a blast. I do not understand the hell it catches. The sort of... the people who bash that movie, their objections don't make any sense coming from the fact that they're fans of the older movies. I'm like, okay, I understand if you hate the entire franchise and you hate the remake. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But if you're telling me you're completely on board with all of those previous installments,
exactly,
even pre-Jason Goes to Hell, but you're bashing the shit out of the remake for having not terribly well-drawn characters or...
Yeah, it baffles my mind. So you hate... the remake, but you're going to stand in line at midnight to watch Jason Goes to Manhattan. You have mental problems.
Yeah. I agree. Well, hopefully we'll see all those characters again soon. And hopefully we get Leatherface back on screen soon again, too. Like, hopefully that kickstarts that franchise again. Because, again, I mean, the Hooper movie is so great. If they are going to continue it, it needs to be a franchise deserving of that title, I think.
I think it's so easy. I think it's, for me, it's easy. I think it's just, you know, because you don't really need that much in a Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's not like Michael Myers is like, you have to have Michael Myers. Now, do you have to have Laurie Strode? Do you have to have Sam Loomis? You know, that's, I don't think you do. But that's, I think, what gets pigeonholed people is like, oh, God, we got to put Laurie in there. Why do you have to put Laurie in there? You don't have to put Laurie in there. Or you have to put somebody resembling Laurie or Laurie's niece or Laurie's, you know, great granddaughter or something like that.
Yeah, there's that weird family thing that I think Carpenter, you know, put in there in Halloween 2. And I think, you know, the one thing that would have kept Halloween rolling and free from needing a reboot, I think, is if they just returned him back to being the boogeyman from the first film. You know, if you run across his path, you're doomed. That's all you really need out of him.
Yeah, just send him back to Haddonfield killing people. I mean, it's you know, simple. So
to finish up here, what would you say, what are the essential elements for a Texas Chainsaw movie?
Atmosphere, shoot in Texas, shoot on Super 16, and a great story, but don't go too far into who Leatherface is. Make his family scary and crazy. That's pretty much it.
I agree entirely. Sir, I think we've pretty much taken up much of your time at this point.
No worries. I can talk about this stuff like for 9 years.
Well, thanks so much for being on. Now, what can fans keep an eye out for from you here?
The Devil's Dolls comes out this Friday. You can get it on VOD, Amazon, or iTunes, and it's going to be a limited theatrical. It's going to be New York, Los Angeles, Ohio, Seattle, and I think St. Louis.
Excellent. Very cool. I just checked out the trailer last night. I think it looks fantastic. I can't wait to see it.
Watch the opening. Then you know my love for Texas Chainsaw Massacre when you watch the opening.
Really? Okay, excellent.
That's my calling card for me to go do a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie right there.
Well, sir, thanks again so much. And thanks again to all you listeners for tuning in to Scream Addicts. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, tell your friends about us. Check out our YouTube show. Just search for Scream Addicts. Make certain to use the Amazon links at the bottom of the page to purchase the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Rites of Spring, Mr. Reynolds' previous movie. Also, we still have an exclusive deal for you through Audible. Sign up for a free 30-day trial. Get 2 free books. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Look what your brother did to that dog!